Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Dancing with Shiva, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Good morning. To welcome Shiva Kumaran from Mauritius. Welcome, Vanakkam. Today is our change of ritual. We're moving into the moksha ritual and have a flag raising ceremony after we end here in the temple. And if our flag raising supplies aren't ready, you're welcome to get them ready. Hopefully they are. So this morning I just have a few thoughts prepared on affectionate detachment. And thinking about it this morning and came up with a threefold concept, two stages leading up to the stage of affectionate detachment. First one is called unaffectionate attachment. Unaffectionate attachment. Second one is called unaffectionate detachment. And then the third one is called affectionate detachment. So what does unaffectionate attachment refer to? Well, it refers to a state of mind that we sometimes end up in as young adults and older adults. We don't start out that way as children, certainly. But it's a state of mind where we're filled with things like resentment, misunderstandings, bad memories of our growing up, grudges. And quite often this is children toward parents or younger children toward older children in the family. And we're just filled with them. We're constantly thinking about the past and what happened when we were 12 years old and what happened when we were 20 years old. And we're obviously attached. There was a wonderful movie we saw sometime in the last few months, Shirley MacLaine movie, where she was the mother, Meryl Streep was the daughter. And they reached a scene where the daughter started rattling off, "Well, when I was 10 years old, you did this to me. And then at my 12th birthday, that happened. When I was 15, you did this. When I was 20, I brought a boy home and that happened to him. When I was 22, this happened." You know, it's just a classic example of what we're talking about here, unaffectionate attachment. Did the daughter like the mother? No. Very hard feelings. There wasn't any affection. It was unaffectionate. Was there attachment? Yes. There was this strong clinging to the past, which is what Gurudeva means in this context of attachment. Our mind is in the past. We're not in the present. We're still reacting to the past in a very strong way. And of course, this can happen. And if it does happen, then we need to undo it, right? We need to clear the subconscious mind of these kinds of negative attachments, or as I'm calling them, unaffectionate attachments. There's certainly no love in these attachments. There's hard feelings, dislike, even hatred can exist in these kinds of negative feelings about what happened to us when we were growing up from our parents or older brothers or sisters. And even when we're growing up, we can add to it. I remember talking to someone, this was a while ago, but they were adding to it with resentments about the partners in their business, treating them unfairly. Their mind was totally absorbed in, well, the partner did this to me 4 years ago, and then 2 years ago the other partner did that, and last month this happened. And were they in the present? No, they were totally in the past. So if we find our mind dwelling a lot in the past about these kinds of things, we need to clear them out. We need to get rid of them, which is the beauty of Gurudeva's teachings. We not only have the theory, but he gives us certain practices which we can do, very concrete practices, so we can change the subconscious mind, change our nature. Nothing theoretical about it. So, of course, as we all know, we've spent a lot of time with the Mahavasanadaha Tantra in recent years, that's the basic clearing of the subconscious mind, writing down what happened to us each year of our life, and then keeping up with that, writing it down and writing letters to people that we hold resentments against and burning them up and clearing out the subconscious mind helps get rid of a lot of those feelings, those unaffectionate attachments to what happened to us in the past. For really difficult situations, Gurudeva has even given additional prayaschitta, such as the flower prayaschitta, putting a flower in front of a picture of a parent who you really don't like, who you really resent how they treated you in raising you, who you really resent for beating you when you were young. You know, there's a flower prayaschitta and a whole practice that goes along with that, because just writing it down may not get rid of it. It created such a deep impression in the mind, a negative samskara in the mind, that more than writing it down is needed. We have to actually do something physical. So Gurudeva has given advice such as the flower prayaschitta, which is very, very effective. And what happens when we do those kinds of practices like Mahavasanadaha Tantra and the flower prayaschitta? We arrive at the second term here, unaffectionate detachment. We still don't like the person, but at least we're not thinking about them all the time. We've gotten detached. We have no fondness, no love, but we're not thinking about the past. We've understood the situation. It was like in this movie with Shirley MacLaine. The daughter finally, the mother said, "I did the best I could in raising you." And the daughter accepted that finally, realizing that the mother wasn't perfect and she shouldn't expect a perfect childhood. That's unrealistic expectation. So they came to an understanding which created a release of the attachment. But still, it didn't build up affection. We had a cold situation without any attachment. So that's unaffectionate detachment. So, of course, that's not the goal either. And the goal is affectionate detachment. So Gurudeva used to tell a story which shows what affectionate detachment isn't very nicely. It involves Paramahansa Yogananda and one of Paramahansa Yogananda's devotees gave him this beautiful shawl, really exquisite shawl with gold thread through it, design and everything, very expensive, beautiful shawl. And Paramahansa Yogananda thanked the devotee and they were walking around together and he put the shawl on, and before he knew it, the shawl kind of slipped off, was dragging in the mud. And of course the devotee was horrified that, "Oh, my beautiful shawl, it's going in the mud." And then it kept getting lower and lower, and pretty soon it just fell off altogether. And Swami kept walking along, and the devotee was still back thinking of the shawl and wasn't thinking about Yogananda at all, because the gift hadn't been given with detachment. Gift was given, which is wonderful, but there was attachment to the gift, right? All the devotee could think about was the shawl and what was happening to the shawl, and it was his shawl and it was getting dirty and then it was getting ignored. And whereas if he had given it in the right spirit, then whatever Swami did with it wouldn't matter, because it was no longer his shawl. He gave it and became detached from it. So Gurudeva gives us a nice statement about how to cultivate affectionate detachment. The best way to keep the actinic force flowing through the physical body is practicing the art of giving. Doing little things for others you have not been asked to do. That's not hard, right? Doing little things for others you have not been asked to do. Well, it sounds so simple, why bother doing it? Well, okay, I can do that. Why bother doing it? Because I can do it. Well, because it produces results. It actually gets us from unaffectionate detachment to affectionate detachment. It builds up love and good feelings toward those to whom we've had hard feelings in the past. Just this simple practice, over time, you know, of course it doesn't change everything in one action. You know, we give something that wasn't anticipated and a thank you and everything happens. You know, it doesn't cause a total transformation just because it happens once. But repeat it over and over again, just little gifts, doing things for others that they don't anticipate. Changes the nature of the feelings between people and changes something that's unaffectionate into affectionate. Creates more love, more of a feeling of kindness and warmth toward one another than we had before. So, of course, this is an important practice in an ongoing sense because there's always the opportunity for hard feelings to develop in life. You know, it's not like, okay, everything's perfect. I started out, I was unaffectionately attached. I did my Mahavasanadha Tantra, I did my flower prayaschitta, I became unaffectionately detached. I did this for this person, I did that for that person, and built up a certain sense of warmth and friendship, and everything's okay, I'm affectionately detached. I can move on. No, it doesn't work that way. It's something we have to work at the rest of our life because we're interacting with people the rest of our life. So it's just part of interacting with people in a way that hard feelings don't develop, resentments don't develop, we don't start clinging to the past and remembering what happened 2 years ago and not letting it go. No, we cultivate affectionate detachment through this simple practice of doing things for others, giving in ways that weren't anticipated, and therefore hard feelings don't develop. We keep things flowing smoothly and keep nice feelings between people we interact with regularly, both family members and friends and even people at work. If we interact with them regularly and we feel a need for this kind of practice, then we can even do it there. So that leads to a nice affection between people, but Gurudeva even takes it further. Says it eventually leads to greater actinic understanding. So what does that mean? It means not only do we have good, kind feelings about others, but we understand their nature better. Part of the reason that we don't get along with certain people is we just don't understand them. You know, we think everyone's like us. It's a natural assumption, everyone's like me. But you may not meet anyone that's like you your whole lifetime. People are quite different. And the basis for misunderstanding and hard feelings is not understanding one another, clearly not recognizing those differences, different sensitivities people have, different needs different people have, different limitations people have. So when we really are deep into affectionate detachment, not only do we have a kindly feeling for others, but we also understand them in an intuitive way, which is what Gurudeva means by actinic understanding. It's not an intellectual analysis that is done. It's just an intuitive sense of who that person is. And because we understand that person better, we get along with them better. So all of that is contained in the wonderful idea of affectionate detachment. And then for the monks, I thought I'd take the principle one step further. And one of the big differences between monastic life and family life is that in family life, you have friends. You have people you like better than others. You have people you spend more time with than others. These are my friends, right? Friendship, having friends in family life, we don't think twice about it. Those are my friends. These are the people I spend time with on days off and this and that, and people I feel close to. They're my friends. Other people aren't my friends. So it's not that we don't like people who aren't our friends, but we like people who are our friends better, right? That's why we call them friends. Whereas in monastic life, we don't have any friends. The monk has to treat everyone alike. So it's a taking affectionate detachment even a step further, because we're detached in the sense that we don't even form friendships in the first place. And a simple way of thinking about it is to be like the sun and how it shines light. Okay, the sun's up in the sky, and does it shine light more on one person than another because that person's the sun's friend? Of course not. You know, the sun shines light equally on everything. It doesn't distinguish. It's just there radiating light. So the monk needs to be like that, but instead of radiating light, he's radiating love and kindness toward everyone he meets equally. In the monastery, he doesn't like one person more than the other. He radiates love and kindness equally to all. And people he meets in the monastery, in town, the same way. He just radiates the same amount of love and kindness to everyone he meets. That's the monastic path. I think Gurudeva was a wonderful master of that, and that's why so many people feel touched by him, because you know, he didn't distinguish. If he was in a restaurant and a waiter came up, you know, that waiter got just as much love and kindness from Gurudeva as the mayor would or the president of this or that. You know, Gurudeva did not distinguish according to social level or income or background or ethnic group or anything. No, every person that Gurudeva met, he treated the same. Shined love and kindness on them just as much as anyone else, and therefore, when we have gatherings on the island of people that were touched by Gurudeva, everyone comes. You know, the whole social structure comes. Whereas you won't find that in most places. This is very unusual, and it shows Gurudeva's monastic quality of just not limiting, not choosing some people over others, but just radiating his love and kindness equally on all people that he encountered in his daily life. So those are the three stages of getting up to affectionate detachment. Unaffectionate attachment, unaffectionate detachment, and affectionate detachment, which comes in two stages. First, just having more love and kindness in our feelings toward others, and then actually understanding them more clearly, understanding the nature of our family and friends in an intuitive way, and therefore loving them more and being able to get along with them better because we understand who they are from the inside out. Om Namah Shivaya. Let the monks go first here. Start our parade in a few minutes. The time of year where we get more rain than usual. I think we have three seasons according to Gurudeva. This is called the rainy cold season. We have the rainy this season, the rainy that season, and the rainy cold season. Three rainy seasons. And as we know, sometimes in January it gets very cold in the morning. So rain or water is very important. One of the testimonies to that is the Tirukkural. As you may recall, there's four chapters in the introduction to Tirukkural. First one is God, of course, right? Most important thing, God. After God, what does Tiruvallavar think is second in importance? Rain. You need rain to have life on earth, so particularly in South India, it's a bit fickle. You know, it comes just during the monsoon season. So rain is the second most important aspect of life on earth to Tiruvallavar. A third, of course, is Dharma. And fourth is sannyas. Four most important things there in the introduction. So we're very fortunate when it comes to water. We live next to a river. And again, in Tirukkural, even for a fortress, you need water. And for an ashram, of course, it's considered very important for an ashram to be near a sacred river. One of the problems of being somewhere for 30 plus years is it's easy to stop really seeing something. You know, you've been looking at it for 30 years. And the river is like that. In fact, all of the beauty that we see when we go outside here is like that. And we can stop really seeing it, stop really looking at it if we don't think about it. You know, we're walking along, going out for a walk, and we come back 30 minutes later, and what did we experience? Maybe our own thoughts. Maybe we didn't see anything. And there's a wonderful way of checking if you're seeing things. It's by being with children, because children see things. They're not so wrapped up in their own thoughts. So if you're walking along and the children are pointing out this, this, and this, and this, and you're not seeing it, you know you're in your thinking mind. You're not really seeing what's there. You're not really appreciating what's there. You're taking it for granted. You're just walking along, living in your own thoughts. But it's worthwhile to stop and control our thoughts and to make sure we're really seeing what's there, listening to what's there, and enjoying what's there. So when it comes to the river, of course, in the spirit of the Tirukkural, it provides sustenance. And even on our own property here, though it looks like the river is down there and we're up here, if you go back upstream, you'll find that part of the river is diverted into the reservoir, Slugit Reservoir, and that reservoir provides the stream which goes through our property. So all the water that goes through the streams on our property is coming from the river, and it's providing both beauty for our Iravan Path of the Nayanars as well as irrigation water for our crops and water for our cows. So the river provides us with sustenance. And on a very practical level, a level that everyone can understand, gives us a swimming hole. It's a great place to go swimming, particularly when it gets hot, and even some of our neighbors petition us during certain times of the year, "Oh, please, 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 you know, can't I bring my kids up swimming?" But on a religious level, of course, it's much more important than that. When it comes to rivers, we have symbolism and sacredness to look at. So the classic symbolism regarding rivers and oceans is one of the soul merging with God, right? And this is found in the introduction to merging with Shiva. There's 9 ways to merge with Shiva given to us in the introduction to merging with Shiva. So if you haven't read that for a while, it's very worthwhile. So the last one has to do with the soul body merging into the primal soul. Of course, we know that's Vishvagrasa, the soul body merging into the primal soul. So the beauty of the ocean symbolism is it's easy to understand. You know, the process starts through evaporation. We have the water droplet coming out of the ocean, going into the clouds, coming down as rain, going down the river, going back into the ocean. And once it gets back into the ocean, where is it? You know, I mean, you can ask a child. The child can understand. You know, where is it? You know, where'd it go? Well, it became one with the ocean, right? I mean, you can't find it once it gets back in the ocean. It's just part of the entire ocean. You can't pull it out again. It's gone. It's become part of the whole. Not gone in the sense of disappeared, but gone in the sense of it has no more individual existence. It's become the whole. You can't distinguish it from the whole. So it's a beautiful symbolism that we have, and it's 9 in our list of ways to merge with Shiva in dancing with Shiva. Looking for a moment at the sacredness of rivers, one of the concepts, and on our property, Of course, we have them just on a very small scale, a mini scale, the idea of sangham. So usually when we say sangham, we think of a group of people, right? Sangham. But sangham also means where two rivers join, a sangham. So those of you who have been to such places in India know that when two sacred rivers join, it's considered even more sacred than in each of them individually. So during where the sangham is, you'll find very special bathing ghats there for religious bathing. And on our property, we have a mini sangham, which is our Balihai Falls, where it meets the river. It has the same vibration as the sangham. And if you go there and meditate, it has the sense that somehow in this meeting of two rivers of water, devas are present. Extra devas are there that don't usually come along with a single body of water. But somehow the merging of two different bodies of water creates an unusual vibration. And it's like it's a special place in the inner world somehow. And you can sense extra devas there. And so it's a wonderful place for meditation on our property or in India for bathing and meditation as well. Another part of the river is you can watch and learn from it because it's life. And you can understand qualities about life by just watching the different events that take place in the river. So, for example, this time of year, you know, we can have some really strong rainstorms. And in the past, you know, we've looked out the window and in this pouring down rainstorm, what do you see coming down the river? You see entire trees coming down the middle of the river, bouncing along, bounce, 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 one after the other. Trees coming down the river. And you get all kinds of debris coming down the river. And because the river's high, it leaves the debris high on the shore. So if you go down there a couple of days later, you'll find your shoreline high up is covered with all this debris. And the river is back down to its normal level, and you've got a mess, right? You've got a big mess. It takes forever to clean that up. So one of the monks one day, you know, I saw in that situation, and I thought it was a very interesting approach. Still raining, but the river had come down. The monk was out there throwing the debris into the river while it was still nearby. You know, you just turn around and you throw it. Instead of having to walk 20 feet, which you'd have to do in a couple of days, you go out right away before it drops too much. It's just dropped enough so you can go down and easily clear this debris that the storm had brought up. Very interesting approach, right? So what does that mean? I mean, what can we learn from that? Well, we can learn that, you know, timing is important. And one of Gurudeva's wonderful qualities is that he's so much in the present, he's always ready to act. You know, lots of people don't want to act. They want to think about things. Well, let's think about it. Let's have a meeting. Let's discuss it. Let's sleep on it. You know, that wasn't Gurudeva, of course. He said, well, let's do it. And everybody else would have to rush because they weren't quite ready. They weren't in the now as much as Gurudeva. You know, let's do it now. Oops. Guess I should be careful what I bring up. We may end up doing everything right now. So, this little example of the river shows that timing is important in life. And that, you know, we can look at the debris as a difficult situation, some karma that's come to us, something unusual, something that's a bit hard to handle. And the lesson is, if we handle it right away, it may be much more efficient. If we're willing to be so much in the now that we say, well, how can we dispatch this right now? Instead of going back and feeling sorry for ourselves, which is the other reaction, we say, oh, what a mess. I feel so discouraged. I just cleaned that up last week. This is terrible. You know, we kind of sulk around for a few days. We miss the chance. But if we can look at it without becoming emotional about it, maybe if we react to this problem, this difficulty, immediately, we'll be able to dispatch it in a much more efficient way without it becoming a real problem to us. We had another storm recently. This one was this year. And it brought down this huge stump and dumped it right on the path, which sometimes happens. So you go down there and there's this huge stump. It's too big to lift. And if you want to do something, you have to call in someone to help. Usually we call in the Tongans. You know, we have Tongan friends. They come in with their chainsaws and spend half a day down there and cut it up and dispatch it. But this time, we didn't have a chance to do that. It came there and we tried to move it and it was too large. And then what happened? Another storm came 1 or 2 days later and took it away. It was the most amazing thing. It just vanished. We went down there and it was totally gone. Something that you wouldn't expect. So again, it shows you that life is not constant. That life has its ups and downs. It has its different moments. And to be attuned to them is advantageous. And to be out of tune with them, it's a lot harder. We're making things difficult that we could make easy. So if we can manage to stay attuned to the ebbs and flows of life, we can make our life smoother and more sublime. So all of that is what the river tells us. Very interesting. Ganga Sadhana. We all know Ganga Sadhana. And I'm sure, you know, I could ask anyone in the room to explain Ganga Sadhana. We all know it. Yes, we're sitting there with our leaves and our flowers, right? Right there on the river. Every time we have a thought, you know, we put it into the leaf, takes it away, and then we grab the flower and offer it to the river and in appreciation for the river taking the thought away, right? Ganga Sadhana. We're all experts at answering what Ganga Sadhana is. But again, it's something we can take for granted. Here we are next to this beautiful river with a beautiful spot for Ganga Sadhana. Are we really performing Ganga Sadhana frequently enough? Well, how do we know? What's the purpose of Ganga Sadhana? Well, the purpose of Ganga Sadhana isn't simply to put leaves and flowers in the river, of course. It's not even to listen to the river saying Om Namah Shivaya. It's to become attuned to the river, to become one with the river. And after we become one with the river is easy because it makes a noise. That's why Gurudeva chose the river. There's a sound, so it catches your attention. It's roaring at you. You know, you're sitting there and this roar is there. You can't ignore it. It's even louder than your thoughts. It's roaring at you. So you become one with this roar by hearing it as Om Namah Shivaya. But we don't stop there, right? Once we become one with the river, we keep going. We become one with the river banks. We become one with the trees. We keep going, the sky, the mountain, everything we can see, we become one with nature. That's the spirit of Ganga Sadhana. So, how do we know if we would benefit from Ganga Sadhana? Well, it's an easy question to ask. Do we feel totally peaceful and totally content? We can ask ourselves that. At this very moment, am I totally peaceful and totally content? I'm just so happy and well-adjusted and uplifted and at peace with everything. No thoughts about the past, no thoughts about the future, no worries, no concerns, no misunderstandings that I recall. I'm just totally peaceful and content. Well, if we can say yes, then maybe we can skip Ganga Sadhana for today. You know, but if we can't say yes, we say, no, I'm not really totally peaceful. I'm kind of disturbed about this, kind of disturbed about that. No, I'm not really content because I wish things were different than they are. I wish this would be this way and that would be this way and this would be different. You know, if we answer like that, that means we can benefit from Ganga Sadhana. Definitely, we can benefit from it. So it's just like taking the idea of not seeing the river or listening to the river because we're taking it for granted, a step deeper. We're taking Ganga Sadhana for granted. We know what it is. We know it's there. Because it's so accessible, we take it for granted and we don't use it enough. But it's such a profound practice and so simple. You know, it's something we should definitely avail ourselves of. Just like when we take a walk, we want to see what we are seeing, listen to what's out there, hear the birds, look at the flowers, and not just totally be involved in our own thoughts. Wonderful chapter in Merging with Shiva, chapter 4, called The River of Life. And Gurudeva gives us another symbolism for the river, that the water flowing through the river is our life force. It's a wonderful meditation. Gurudev explains it as actinic force. Actinic force is not a force from the superconscious mind, rather it is the superconscious mind. So our pure life force, superconsciousness. And he likens that to the water that's flowing down the center of the river, like the central stream of the river. When you sit next to a river, particularly in areas where it's not super wide, but, you know, upstream like we are, you'll see a phenomena where water gets caught on the side. All the water doesn't go down the center. You know, you see water caught over here, there's a boulder. It's stuck behind a boulder. And unless the stream rises higher, it's going to remain stuck behind that boulder. Stuck behind the boulder because the water level has come down a little bit. So this water is stuck over there. It's not moving. We have water over here that's stuck because there's some logs that are blocking it. So the mainstream is going along, but we have water stuck here and there all along the river. So, what is the symbolism? Well, all of it is our energy. But the water that's flowing down the center of the river is like actinic force that's flowing through us without hindrance. Water that's stuck here and there is like attachments. It's our energy that's caught up in some kind of concern, usually about the past. We find ourselves reflecting on misunderstandings that occurred last year, or it could be about ourselves. Boy, that stupid thing we did 2 years ago. You know, we think about it every day. We haven't resolved it. But we can also be attached to the future. We can be worried about the future. Worried about losing our job. Every day we're worried. Gee, I might lose my job today. Or we're worried about how some business deal we're doing will work out. Not just thinking about it, but we're worried about it. Meaning we think about it more than we should. And we think about it with just part of our mind. When we think about the future correctly, our full mind is on it in a very organized way, and we're thinking it through. Worry is we're thinking it through just part way, and then we abandon it. That's what worry is. You just think about it a little bit, and then you jump to something else. You think about that a little bit, you jump to something else. Rather than taking the time to think it through carefully, make a conclusion, even write the conclusion down and say, this is what I'm going to do. I don't have to think about this again. That's planning for the future. Planning for the future is good. Worrying about the future is not good. It's like putting energy off to the side. We're tying up this energy instead of allowing it to flow with the main river of life. We're putting it against the side. It's like water stuck behind a big boulder. So you can just look at the river, imagine the Wailua River from the beginning to the end, and there's lots of water that's stuck behind boulders and rocks and branches and trees and everything that are our attachments. So the more we can get rid of those, the more of our energy flows with the river of life, right? It's just in the mainstream. It's like when the river is high, all of the water flows in a stream. It's only when the river drops to a certain level that it starts to collect along the bank in various ways. So similarly in our life, we have lots of inspiration, lots of actinic energy, lots of upliftment going. There's no attachments. It's when our energy level goes down, our inspiration goes down, that we get into the sense of attachments and worries about the future, concerns about the past. So, what's the goal? Well, in this symbolism, the goal is to get into the ocean. The ocean in this symbolism is not merging with Shiva. It's just Shiva consciousness. That if our energy flows straight, we can be in Shiva consciousness, which is the goal, blissful consciousness, consciousness of oneness. But if our energy is divided into all these little side pools of attachment, then we don't experience Shiva consciousness. So we need to let go of the attachments in a systematic way. How do we know if we've let go of the attachments? Well, we find ourselves in the present. When the actinic force is strong, when our superconscious force is strong, we're in the eternal now. Beautiful phrase, the eternal now. Meaning, we don't think much about the past. We're not worrying about the future. We're enjoying the present in a peaceful, contented way. That's the eternal now, and that's the goal. So a very simple measure is, you know, how much are we thinking about the past? How much are we worrying about the future? How much are we really in the present? Another measure is, how is life responding to us? How is our timing? Timing is a very good measure of how much we're in the eternal now. Is our timing good or is our timing bad? We call up someone, oh, they just left. You know? Do we call up someone, oh, they just came in? You know, how is our timing? You know, one incident isn't enough, but if that happens throughout the day, you can judge, you know, how your timing is. Are you really attuned to life or are you out of sync with life? Are you banging into it? Things are not going smoothly. You really want to talk to someone, but someone calls you. Oh, you know, that's a good sign that life is, you're in tune with life, that you're flowing with your superconscious. So, if you find you're not flowing with your superconscious, you don't have to give up. Say, uh-oh, this is going to be a terrible day. Everything's going to go wrong. Maybe I should go back to bed. Call in sick. No. Stop at the temple. Do a Ganesha Puja. Meditate. Do something to change your consciousness. Because it's within your power. It just has to do with the state of mind you're in. It's not some fate that's external to you that you can't change. My fate today, my astrology of the day is everything's going to go wrong. No. Is that somehow you're not in your best state of consciousness. Something's distracted you. Something's disturbed you. Maybe you need to write it down and burn it up. You know, give some thought. Why am I not in my best state of consciousness? If these kinds of things start happening to you, write it down, burn it up. Change your consciousness. Get rid of the attachment. Get more energy flowing through you and not tied up in attachments. And then life responds in a smooth way. So all of that is about water. Isn't it wonderful how much we can learn from water and rivers and symbols and sacredness and swimming holes and sustenance? Om Namah Shivaya.